From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
Hey, Ann. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing? I'm back in New York City.
Oh, welcome back to the Thanks. City of New York.
The anarchist
city. Do you feel like an anarchist?
Not yet, but, you know, give me time.
So there's a big event coming up. It has me a little nervous.
Yes, me too. The debate.
No. I'm not talking about the debate. I'm talking about the CAFE happy hour on Thursday evening. Look, the debate's important.
I can't be nervous for that yet.
It's important for America, but before we get to substantive matters, we should remind people that we're going to have a happy hour, virtual, bring your own drinks, BYOB, Thursday, October 1 at 6:30 p.m. via Zoom. You can tune in to watch or to listen. If you already get CAFE emails, you should have already received an invitation in the CAFE brief newsletter. And if you don't, and you want to hang out with me and Ann and the other CAFE hosts, that includes Lisa Monaco, Ken Weinstein, John Carlin, Ellie Honig, go to cafe.com/Preet and sign up, and we'll send you an invitation. The Zoom link will be sent on the day of the event, a few hours before it begins.
Yeah, and I should alert people that the happy hours are really fun. They're
People? That's an alert? I should alert
it's a
you.
Newsflash.
Usually that's a warning. I should alert you. That the happy hours are quite
fun. Well, just if people are expecting a lot of wonky policy, like
be very droll.
It tends to be a little more lighthearted.
Yeah, no, I get that.
You've been warned, Preet.
All right. So again, that's cafe.com/Preet. There is no cost. This is a free service. Be warned. It's a lot of fun. So before we get to the Supreme Court, which is the dominant news, and I think one of the most important things happening in the country, can I ask you a personal question, Ann?
Always.
Did you pay more than $750 in federal income taxes last year?
I did. In fact, I can't really
think of— Does that make you a sucker? Are you a sucker?
You know, I can't really think of a time since maybe even college or before college when I paid that amount of money or less. I mean, it's that long. Look, it's astonishing, Preet. And I know, you know, I understand that you can't charge people with a crime based solely on a tax return. And so I watched sort of the analyst yesterday being very thoughtful on this, but it's stunning. And like, there are not many things in life that you have to do as an American. You have to pay your taxes and you have to do jury duty. And if there's a war and there's
conscription. And take out the garbage. You got to take out
the
garbage.
Well, yeah, that's your personal one. But there's not a lot of things you have to do. And so it really is. I mean, it's incredibly striking. And look, we'll talk about this another time, but I think there are issues of, you know, obviously the potential tax fraud, but also the bank fraud, the investigation that the Manhattan DA's office and the state AG in New York have been doing. And also, you know, potentially there have been conversations about insurance fraud with some of the transactions that are potentially listed. And so I just think there's a lot there for prosecutors and investigators to go through. And certainly there'll be plenty for us to talk about. And the time says that more is coming. So,
That's an important point.
Yeah. I couldn't put it down either. I don't know about you, but that article, dropped everything.
In case you've been living under a rock, this is the blockbuster New York Times story from the last couple of days that talks about all the ways in which Trump has avoided taxes, which is different from evading taxes. And I think that remains to be seen. A couple of the stunning things, and we'll get on to the Supreme Court. You know, the article notes that just based on his time working on The Apprentice, Donald Trump made $427.4 million through 2018, and at prior times made substantial sums of money and yet owed almost nothing in taxes. I guess 10 of 15 years, $0 in taxes. In 2016, the year he was elected, and the following year when he was in office, paid only $750 in taxes. And, you know, a lot of people, including noted conservative Ann Coulter, I saw this morning, said, you know, it is not the right talking point and the retort from Republican allies of the president to say, well, good for him. Everyone should figure out a way not to pay taxes and take advantage of loopholes. And this is Ann Coulter, so it's interesting, said any system in which, I or an ordinary citizen pays half their income in taxes and a billionaire pays nothing is a system that's in need of redress, right?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair takeaway. Regardless of whether or not there are specific crimes here, the fact that this has gone on and obviously been allowed to go on for decades it's shocking. And look, I was fascinated by just reading that even the sort of most aggressive extreme wealth individuals who look for every tax haven, every possible way to avoid taxes, end up paying about 24%. So they don't pay close to half of their income as many of us do. They pay, you know, a quarter, but still, you know, Donald Trump, you're talking about paying zero taxes for 11 years and for 2 years paying $750 when you're talking about millions that he's showing as assets, as income. It's unbelievable. And so I couldn't agree more that there's a bigger conversation that has to take place here too.
Yeah. And look, like everything else with Donald Trump, and maybe it's just because when people talk to me, they always want to ask about crimes, and maybe that happens with you also. But whether or not something is a crime doesn't mean there are not other reasons to be deeply concerned about them. And I think the most distressing thing about this is the part of the story that reports that Donald Trump is potentially deeply in debt and has loans that are coming due for which he is personally liable to the tune of $421 million, most of that coming due in the next 4 years, which would mean if he gets reelected during his presidency. And it's not clear he has the wherewithal to pay it back. It's not also, it's also not clear
at all.
It's
not clear who he owes that money to.
Right.
Which is,
what if it's
which
Vladimir?
Is unacceptable, right? It's unacceptable that you would have a president that has that level of liabilities, basically potential exposure to blackmail, to problems, who could be beholden to other people, and we don't know who it is. That is completely unacceptable. And by the way, that's why historically, not just presidents divest, but like all government officials divest, right? You know, you left a law firm to go to the U.S. Attorney's office. Like, you know, I negotiated this a lot when I was AG. There would be senior people who were in business or in law who were entering government service. They had to divest, and we helped them work through like what was required. But you just can't have people out there with existing. You can't serve two masters when you serve the people of the United States.
Well put. And by the way, this whole funny business about Donald Trump saying fake news, the New York Times is fake news. One of his lawyers basically said most facts in there are false. Well, there's a pretty easy way to prove that they're false.
Yeah, release them.
Release them.
Yeah.
So I don't fully get it. One last point about
I found the denials very weak for what it's worth, and very, you know, attacking that they were illegal leaks, never your strongest argument when you're trying to say that something isn't true.
Yeah, I know there were previous reports about Trump's taxes from an earlier period, and that didn't last a long time in the news cycle. I think this one, because it's closer in time, the period that's being examined, and it's close in time to the election. And the figures are, I think, even more astonishing, both the amount of money he's paid in taxes, federal taxes, and the amount of money he potentially owes third parties makes it a much bigger deal and a much bigger story. And I would imagine it's going to come up in the debate. But a question I have for you is, obviously the IRS mostly deals with, you know, collecting taxes, but there's also a criminal component. And they do criminal investigations based on information that they might have about fraud, tax evasion, et cetera. And I'd be curious to know if the Times has any evidence that the IRS, aside from having this long-time audit that's been going on with the president's tax returns and a particular tax refund he got of $73 million, if they have also opened up a criminal investigation. Because that's the entity to do it, right?
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, I think there's potential, you know, as I said, bank fraud, that it wouldn't necessarily be the IRS who would do bank fraud or some other types of white collar fraud that could be here. But you would expect, yes, that the IRS would look at this. I mean, there are the deductions around consultant fees that look like they were Donald Trump's children, the taking of sort of an investment property around the Seven Springs house in Westchester that was clearly not used as an investment property. I mean, there's a lot of just what I would say are like real red flags. And I would also just add that IRS agents tend to be, in my experience, excellent. They're the sort of folks that, you know, they're happy to be in a like tiny broom closet with, they're not going to appreciate this description, but like with like stacks and stacks of files around them. And they just are like, they just work through paper and complex financial arrangements. And so I would sort of suspect that has happened or is happening. And I would hope actually that it is. I mean, there's so much potentially problematic here.
Well, as you pointed out at the beginning, the New York Times has more stories to come. And obviously they've been working
on it. It's
going to
be a drumbeat up until the election,
yeah,
I suspect.
It's sort of interesting
every couple
to see
weeks.
Well, yeah, and what the denials are. And it's pretty telling that even in the face of this, Trump will not reveal his taxes, in part maybe because he didn't want people to know that he pays almost nothing in federal income tax. So there are a lot of stories, obviously, that are going around. We have limited time, so we're going to focus on the Supreme Court and get to some of those other stories, including the president's taxes, in the coming weeks. So Saturday, prime time, lots of flags in the Rose Garden. The president nominated Amy Coney Barrett. Are you surprised that it was her and not Barbara Lagoa or someone else?
You know, I think you and I had both had sort of felt the same, which was Barbara Lagoa felt to me like just an all-around smart pick for a lot of reasons, including the fact that she would be the first Latina Republican justice. She's from Florida, just felt aligned. And I think also she's deeply conservative, just like Amy Coney Barrett. So I sort of felt like you would get almost everything you would get with Amy Coney Barrett, but you wouldn't get the sort of culture war and the sort of just, you wouldn't have someone who had so explicitly articulated views that I think will lead to the overturning of things like women's right to choose and so on. And so I think it made more political sense to do Lagoa. That's not who Donald Trump is. And I think as I've reflected on it, right, he loves the fight. He always plays offense. And I think it was reported that he had told people he was saving Barrett for Ginsburg's seat. And so in some ways, I'm not surprised, but I don't know if you had the same reaction.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense. And he had his eye on her, as you say, for the Ginsburg seat all along. I think the other thing going on is, even though Barbara Lagoa in ordinary times might get more bipartisan support or some bipartisan support, she was confirmed for this 11th Circuit, I think by a vote of 80 to 15. Whereas Amy Coney Barrett was 55 to 43, only three Democrats crossed party lines to vote for Barrett.
And one of them was her home state senator,
right,
which is pretty common.
Time,
so I, yeah.
Yeah, but in these circumstances, given how angry Democrats, I think rightfully are, that they're going to push through a confirmation on the eve of the election, even though McConnell said something very, very different and Graham said something very, very different in 2016, it almost didn't matter. There was going to be a conflagration no matter who he nominated. And I think he decided to go with the person who is more embraced by the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation.
And by his base. I agree.
And by his base. Because she's so much more clear on a litmus test issue like Roe v. Wade. And we'll get to that in a minute. But in retrospect, it seems almost, you know, I was talking to some reporters who were calling and asking my opinion on things. And every single one of them said, no, it's not going to be Lagoa. It's going to be Amy Coney Barrett. And it's not even clear to me he interviewed anyone else.
No, it was reported that he'd only interviewed Barrett.
So
I don't know if that's accurate or not, but yeah.
So let's, I think maybe let's talk generally about how different the court is going to be. Whether it was Barrett or Lagoa, a number of things probably will not be the same for a long time because you're moving from a 5-4 court and a 5-4 court on which, as people know, John Roberts sometimes would vote with the liberals and has done it a couple of times in the last year. Not to say he's trending left or drifting to the left, but on certain issues, because he has a certain view of institutions and he has a certain view of pretextual arguments that have been made by this administration, he has been a vote on the liberal side. That's not going to matter anymore if Barrett is confirmed, because it's going to be 6-3 on issue after issue after issue, right?
I agree. And I think it's hard to explain to people how important that is, that with the 5-4, you know, there's room. And there's always, we've seen Roberts sometimes join the progressive justices, that will not happen. There will be a solid, and to be clear that the existing five, the existing four, take Roberts out for a minute, are deeply conservative and they are a reliable, extreme conservative vote. And so I think that's really important, and Barrett will be as well. So it's not like when you think about justices who get on the court and really look at each case in a unique, you know, sort of uniquely, and they take the facts and the law and what the Constitution says. This is a situation where we do know that the court is going to swing hard right. And I think we also have to be honest that, in my view, the president is working to pack the court to do just this by doing this before the election. It's really
during,
clear to me. During the election, yes.
I think it's just an important point. People forget that because there's so much early voting.
No, I think it's an important point. And I think it's also important to understand that this is court packing, that Garland, in my view, should have been seated in the Obama administration. He, you know, Scalia's seat was open in February. The election was not until November. Here you have a situation where the election is, as you say, happening now. It is basically almost October, and we're talking about the president jamming through something with the intent of swinging the court for the next 30 to 50 years in a conservative way. And we should maybe just highlight, you know, people sort of think generally about these things, but, you know, Roberts was the swing vote on immigration recently on the DACA case. He was the swing vote on June Medical Services versus Russo, which was the case that struck down a state law that was restricting abortion and would have created a situation where there was only one abortion provider in the state. And all of that will change. And environmental restrictions, campaign finance, voting. I mean, I would anticipate that ruling after ruling will come out to the far right. And, I wanted to ask you this, Bree, because I've been thinking a lot about the fact that I don't think that that's in sync with America. And, you know, even if you just look at the polling now is a majority of Americans think that the seat should be open for whoever gets elected and sworn in January. A majority of Americans support keeping Roe. And I don't know if that matters, but it feels to me like the court is moving farther and farther out of sync with the country.
I think that's going to continue to happen. I had our friend, our mutual colleague, Melissa Murray on the Stay Tuned podcast last week. And we talked about what is going to be developing as time goes by. 6-3 court, if Trump is reelected, potentially a 7-2 court. As the country, I think, moves a little bit more to the progressive side, the court remains conservative. And you will have these tensions, right? You know, both with FDR when he was trying to pass New Deal legislation. I think we're going to have moments like that in our future as well. And just the last point on the precedent here, and just to reemphasize the fact that we're in an election, people keep saying, well, you know, in the Obama case with Merrick Garland, there was a nomination made during an election year, and this is during an election year. It's not during an election year. Voting has begun in many states. I read somewhere that there have already been 1 million votes cast, and it's not even October. And at this time in 2016, there were just a few thousand votes cast. So this is not a case where, look, oh, let's wait. Let's not wait because we can move now and the election will happen later. The election is already happening. The best analog to the current situation, as some people have mentioned, was 1864 during the re-election of Abraham Lincoln. And there came a Supreme Court vacancy close in time to the election, no early voting then, as far as I know. And President Lincoln waited. He waited until after he won re-election to make a nomination. And that's what should have happened here. Should we talk about what are good arguments and maybe what are not so good arguments about Amy Coney Barrett? And I mention that because there will be a lot of debate and hand-wringing over the issue of her Catholic faith. And, you know, for my part, I think that people, Democrats included, would do well to stay away from that. A, because I think people are entitled to practice their faith the way they see fit. And B, it will be counterproductive and will cause a lot of blowback. And maybe it doesn't matter, because no matter what people say, there will be Republicans who want to raise the straw man argument that her faith is being attacked. I'll give you one example of the stupidest thing I've read since the nomination. Senator Marsha Blackburn tweeted, "In Chuck Schumer's America, only atheists can be Supreme Court justices," which is really fabulously stupid. By the way, I was kind of appalled to see yesterday that Marsha Blackburn started following me on Twitter.
Oh boy.
I don't know why that is.
I don't know what the right reaction to that was, but I was surprised.
By the way, she's talking about only atheists can be in the Supreme Court, according to Chuck Schumer.
It's
literally
not true.
At the same
the
moment.
Court is that, Catholic.
Well, also literally at the same moment that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Jewish woman, is about to be laid to rest. And obviously, Sonia Sotomayor, who was championed by Chuck Schumer, Catholic.
Also, 6 of the current 8 justices are Catholic. They affiliate, they consider themselves to be Catholic. And so I actually don't quite understand why there are so many Catholics on the Supreme Court. It's a very interesting thing. You know, I am Catholic myself, but it just felt, when I saw that fact, it felt very unusual. So I think nothing could be further from the truth that you can't be Catholic and be on the Supreme Court.
Do you know who else is Catholic?
Other than me.
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden is Catholic. That's
the Democrats
right.
hate
Catholic.
The Democrats hate Catholics so much they want to make one president.
That's a good point. Well, the attacks are hollow. I mean, they're really meant to go to the base. And I should say that, you know, there's Pew polling that shows that 59% of Catholics don't want Roe to be overturned. And so it really is this sort of argument that this is about your faith, I think it is intentionally driven to try to get religious conservatives and the president's base to think that somebody is trying to stop someone because of their religion. My personal view is I don't care what your religion is. I care what your views are and how you will vote on the court and whatever, you know, you sort of bring to that personally is completely distinguishable for me as to how you see your role vis-a-vis the laws and the Constitution of the United States. And so I think there's going to be a lot of attention potentially focused on it. I think it's kind of a mistake. I will point out one thing, though, that one thing and that I saw that really did give me pause was an answer that Barrett had given about the death penalty. And so when she was previously asked about her willingness to basically uphold the law, look, agree or disagree, the death penalty is the law in many states and also in the federal government. And so if you're sworn in as a federal judge, it is legitimate to expect that everyone will apply the law. Again, you can disagree with that. You can vote for people who want to change that rule. You can become a policy activist. But if you become a judge, or frankly, I even felt as a prosecutor, you have to be willing to uphold the law. And so she said something where she would not personally sign an execution order. If she was a district court judge, she would not sign that. And I think in questioning, she has to be pushed not on why she thinks the death penalty is wrong. It may or may not come from her faith. I don't care where it comes from. But I think she has to be pushed on her view of seeing herself as above the law, as outside the law, and not having to adhere to it. And that, to me, that is a really fair question of, again, having nothing to do with your faith, but, you know, are you willing to sort of pledge fidelity to the Constitution and laws of the United States? When thinking about the sort of this question of whether or not a Supreme Court justice should be seated, Barrett herself, the president's nominee, has spoken on this. And she made statements when Justice Scalia's seat was open, again, going back to February of the last year of President Obama's presidency. And she was trying to distinguish it from when Justice Kennedy had been sworn in. And Justice Kennedy had been nominated and confirmed also during an election year. So she's trying to distinguish that situation in explaining why Merrick Garland shouldn't get a vote and shouldn't be seated. And she said,
Kennedy is a moderate Republican, and he replaced a moderate Republican, Powell. We're talking about Justice Scalia, you know, the staunchest conservative on the court, and we're talking about him being replaced by someone who could dramatically flip the balance of power on the court. It's not a lateral move.
So, you know, that's not the way it works. There is no Democrat or Republican seat. If there was, we would be arguing that Ginsburg's seat should go to Democrats. But I really hope that the sort of hypocrisy of that statement will be brought to bear. I mean, you could not go further in terms of jurisprudence from Ginsburg to Barrett. There's a huge, huge distinction.
I saw that too. You know, I think the larger point she was making in the extended clip for the interview, it's a little less clear if she was being hypocritical or was just sort of talking about different circumstances and saying there's no concrete governing rule with respect to these things. So I sort of leave that aside. So before we get into a couple of different specific issues, we've already talked about the death penalty. You know, overall, even though she's got a short track record on the court, on the circuit court, 3 years, and hasn't written in a lot of controversial opinions, she does embrace certain things. She calls herself an originalist, which has a particular meaning, and Heritage Foundation folks and Federalist Society folks love that. She basically said she embraces and considers herself to be in the philosophical mind of Antonin Scalia, also an originalist, also known as a strict textualist, by which I think what people mean is that's a view of constitutional interpretation that depends heavily, if not exclusively, on trying to figure out what the original public meaning was of those words, even if they were 200 and something odd years ago, as opposed to having an appreciation for a living document. And that
yes, and the text of the Constitution 200 years ago, and really, really pinning that to the actual language that's used and the actual language of, you know, if they pulled from common law in England to create provisions of the American Constitution, what was the specific text of the language they pulled from the common law, for example. And so it really does focus on the text and the language of the original Constitution. It basically leads you to a very conservative view. And I think it should allow us to assume that Barrett will vote as Scalia would have voted.
Yeah. I mean, explicitly. I mean, we should remind people that she clerked for conservative judge in the D.C. Circuit, Larry Silberman, and then also clerk for Antonin Scalia. So Scalia was a mentor, and she follows in his footsteps, explicitly so. And that even though we only have a 3-year track record on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, It's a predictable vote. Nothing is 100% predictable, but it's a fairly predictable vote on a lot of different issues. Should we talk about a couple of them? I guess one that is important to people is reproductive rights, Roe v. Wade. She, to my knowledge, has not written directly on the substantive issue of a woman's right to choose while on the bench. But she has said some things about choice in her academic writings. A couple of comments that have been interpreted to be not so devastating to the right to choose, which we can mention in a moment. But overall, do you agree that she is probably a pretty reliable vote to at least hollow out the right to choose, if not to overrule Roe 100% directly?
I have no question about that in my mind. I think she is a completely reliable vote on that. And look, I think that the tact now is not to, on the right, is not to explicitly overrule Roe, because I think they've realized that they can really gut it, death by a thousand cuts, by letting states pass onerous restrictions. Some of the restrictions that Barrett has even ruled on, again, she hasn't written the opinions herself, but just sort of joined in opinions, have addressed, you know, can states prohibit abortion based on the sex, gender, or disability of the baby? Basically, really bringing this question of, you know, will states be able to prohibit families from choosing to discontinue a pregnancy if they understand that a child would have severe developmental disabilities, which is currently the law and has been allowed to happen. And so I think that, yes, I think that's exactly what we should expect, is that she would have a series of decisions that would hollow it out. And we should just note that she has herself said that, you know, and this has been publicly reported frequently, but it's worth just noting that Supreme Court precedents are not sacrosanct. And that's sort of her language. She's talked about something called super precedents. And I think she's trying to sort of work through this idea that, look, there's a reason you need precedent, because it allows people to know what the law is and to be able to live their lives and to sort of settle debates. And her argument is Roe still isn't settled. There are still a lot of people who are angry about it and who don't agree with it. And so she's sort of dividing the world into precedents that can be overturned and super precedents that can't be. And so I would very much also like to see members of the Senate Judiciary Committee ask her and grill her on what are super precedents and what are not, and what constitutes a super precedent. But 100% on Roe.
I mean, she has commented on Roe just a year before she went on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals at a discussion at Jacksonville University. She said, quote, "I don't think the core case," and probably she had no expectation of being on the bench in the near term back then, but she said, "I don't think the core case, Roe's core holding that women have a right to an abortion, I don't think that would change. But I think the question of whether people can get very late-term abortions, you know, how many restrictions can be put on clinics, I think that will change," end quote. Now, she was making a prediction about the court as it was constituted and how it might be constituted in the future. That's not really a statement about what she would do if she were on the court, which probably was not something she was expecting to happen in the space of just 4 years from the time she made that statement.
Well, maybe not, but I would say this, like, I don't think it's a coincidence that she hasn't been on either of the panels that decided the abortion case, the two abortion cases that have come before the Seventh Circuit, and she hasn't personally written. She's only joined the writings of others in dissent, right? So I think it's actually very interesting, and it makes me sort of question, you know, whether in some ways it's very convenient. The only other thing I'd say, Preet, is that, you know, there is something about when we talk about Roe, there is something about, I think the president wants the deciding vote on Roe, which this will now be, to be coming from a woman in some ways, right? Like, I think that there's, I don't know if you agree, but I suspect, like, in some ways he's now replacing the sort of the justice who had built the foundation for equality in the United States for women. And he's going to replace her with someone who will cast, I think, the deciding vote to restrict women's ability to choose and in a variety of other ways, sort of step back, roll back some of the actions that Justice Ginsburg took as a litigator and as a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, I think that's right. So on some other issues that are more immediate, like the Affordable Care Act, and I think the Democrats, both as a matter of substance and as a matter of strategy, are rightly focused on this and how her confirmation would likely mean the end of the ACA as we know it. And one of the reasons we can believe that to be true is back in 2017, just 3 years ago, just before she ascended to the bench, she made a statement critical of Chief Justice John Roberts and how he decided an important case in the Supreme Court on the Affordable Care Act back in 2012. And she writes, quote, Chief Justice Roberts pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute. And without getting into too much detail, I think that suggests that she would not push in the same way. And even though the circumstances and the posture is a little bit different in this new ACA case coming up in a few weeks, that she's a pretty reliable vote against the ACA. Agree?
Yes, I do agree. And I think that one of the things that I was just thinking as you were talking is that in the past, I mean, she has said a lot. And, you know, your point is, well, maybe she never thought she'd be on the Supreme Court. But in some ways, all of these statements are what has propelled her in Donald Trump's universe to go on the court, right? For him to put her on the court, because we know what she's going to do. And what Trump is betting is that the confirmation process, that Americans don't care, the public won't object, they won't push Republican senators to vote against her based on it. Like, he's counting on this being rubber stamped. And so he's intentionally gone with the person who said, I'm going to overturn the ACA. I don't agree with Justice Roberts' reading of it. So yes, I completely agree.
Move on to guns quickly, and we'll come back to some of these issues as the hearings get underway. On the issue of guns and gun regulation, she's probably, almost certainly, a very reliable conservative vote on any issue relating to the Second Amendment. There's a particular case and issue that she's ruled upon during her time as a judge, brief time as a judge, and that relates to the right of felons to possess firearms. There's a federal law that prohibits felons, people who have been convicted of a felony, from possessing a firearm. Now, you can like or not like that law, but it has had bipartisan support for a long time. I'm not aware of any significant material effort to change that law, you know, even though there's a Republican Senate and there have been Republican Congresses in the past. And she ruled in a dissent with respect to a person who had been convicted of fraud, saying that the statute is constitutionally overbroad and violates the Second Amendment, that there may be a reason for, you know, a person who is deemed to be dangerous not to be able to possess a firearm for the rest of his life, but that a mere conviction for fraud isn't it. And you can have a view about whether or not that makes sense, but in my experience prosecuting these kinds of cases, and given how many times the constitutionality of that gun regulation has been challenged, and in every case that I'm aware of that rose up to any significant level in the appellate courts, always struck down. So she's an outlier on the gun issue as well.
Yeah, and I think it is an extreme view, and I think it's important to note that this is, again, when you talk about precedent, it's extremely well established that this has been allowed. So she basically, you know, in this case where she's the lone dissenter, she's basically finding a violation of the Second Amendment, and she sort of goes on to be questioning Congress's ability to place limits on the Second Amendment, right? She's questioning whether or not Congress can have a restriction that's this broad when the Second Amendment guarantees the right. She's arguing the Second Amendment allows individuals, all Americans, all individuals to keep and bear arms. And so, you know, in my mind, she's basically saying that Congress can't put restrictions on this in the Second Amendment space when it comes to guns. But if we think about abortion, what she is basically going to get on the court and do is basically say it's fine for states to put numerous restrictions, right? And so to me, I mean, she's going to go back and say, well, my philosophy is the original text of the Constitution. The Second Amendment explicitly says the right to keep and bear arms. And that's going to be her argument. But I think we should be very clear that the way she's approaching these two things, the constitutional right, of course, for Roe was read into the Constitution. It's not explicitly written there. She's going to argue they're different, but in fact, she's going to restrict Congress's ability to put regulations on gun ownership while giving the right to restrict abortion. And it's just, it's incompatible in my view.
So we should talk about how this is going to play out. The bottom line is, based on our discussion, if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed, she's going to alter the trajectory of the court in a right-wing and rightward way for a long time. Someone put it this way, you know, if she serves to the same age as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know how long she'll be on the bench? Till 2059.
Wow.
2059. So here's the plan of ramming through this court pick. Lindsey Graham, who once upon a time said he would never proceed with such a confirmation, has announced that the confirmation hearings will begin on October 12th, holiday for some people, opening statements, 2 days of questioning, October 13th and 14th, and then 1 day of outside witnesses, which is something you typically have at these hearings, with a vote to closely follow. I think he's called for the panel, the committee, to approve her by October 26th. And on this schedule, she would be confirmed before the election. And before people get too upset with me, and we can talk about why this is, I think people should be aware that there is very little likelihood of stopping Amy Coney Barrett. That doesn't mean people shouldn't argue about it and fight about it and draw pain about it and cause it to harm the electoral prospects of both Republican senators and Donald Trump. But the fact of the matter is, if you have the votes, and it looks like McConnell has the votes, you not only have the votes to confirm, you have the votes to change rules, to get around obstacles that Democrats can put in their path. And the smart people I talk to, and based on my own experience, the vast likelihood is, and I hate to say it for a million different reasons, and it makes my blood boil and it makes me angry too, Amy Coney Barrett will be confirmed.
So I agree in one part, which is that I think she will get seated on the court. I do think that there is a possibility of delaying this till after the election, which I feel very strongly about and should be done. And I also agree
how is that?
I think,
because I don't see it.
I think the problem is, look, this is a rocket speed confirmation process that's been laid out. And I don't know, you know, we can talk about some of the procedural things that the Democrats can do, but they can, in fact, make the senator stay in DC. They can basically call for a vote on virtually everything. They can refuse a lot of the unanimous consent that they do in the normal course of their business. Now,
yeah, but none of those things stops, not one of those things, respectfully, stops Lindsey Graham from having the hearing on the day he wants to have the hearings. There is this gambit that people use sometimes where they can end committee hearings after 2 hours by raising an objection. All Lindsey Graham will do in that case is say, okay, great. We had 2 hours of hearings. That's all you get. I'm still going to go for a vote. When I say we're going to go for a vote, people have also talked about boycotting the hearings. I get it. There's a rule in the Judiciary Committee that you can't proceed and act on certain business without a quorum and without at least one or two members of the opposing party. Yeah, that's a rule. But that's a rule that's able to be changed by the majority, by a majority vote, without a quorum, right? So it's kind of meta.
Right. Look, I don't disagree that there's probably a Republican counter move to every potential Democratic move. But here's my view: you know, you give half your sandwich to the bully, and they always eat the other half. And this is nothing but an assertion of pure power by Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell, and Lindsey Graham. And the Democrats need to call it out, and they need to let the American public see that the Republicans are willing to change the rules and bend the rules and literally ram through the woman who will make the Supreme Court the most conservative for all of our lifetime, again, which I believe is out of the heartland of the United States, that they have to basically do this in front of everyone. And look, you may be right that it happens anyway, but I don't feel good about this idea of, well, it's just going to happen, so people should just show up and ask a few questions and feel sorry for themselves that they don't have more power.
Well, do you think they should boycott? Do you think Dianne, first of all, Dianne Feinstein never boycotts anything. That it was suggested to her a number of times when I was on the committee and when you were in the Senate. So putting that aside, because she has a view, whether you like it or not, and she's, I think, is a problematic questioner and was a problematic questioner of Amy Coney Barrett back in 2017. But you think Democrats just don't show up? I mean, the problem with that is, I mean, maybe that shows some solidarity, but then you don't take any shots at Amy Coney Barrett. You then don't have the possibility of maybe ferreting out some bad views that could, you never know, because life is strange, could turn the tide. That would just cause Lindsey Graham, I think, to say, fine, Democrats don't want to have a hearing. We won't have a hearing at all if they're going to boycott. We'll go straight to the floor, and she gets confirmed more quickly.
Right. I think that's a fair argument against boycotting it altogether. I think you could boycott the vote. But I do, at this moment in time, I lean toward there being a process by which, look, it is reprehensible to me that they are going to rush through a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court. It's never been done this quickly. Like, there's just zero precedent for this type of speed happening. And again, it's being done, and we should be clear, it's being done because there's a risk that the president could lose one of the Senate seats with Mark Kelly at the end of November if he wins in Arizona. It also looks even worse if they wait till after the election. And also, the reason to rush it is that if we end up in litigation over the election, I think the president would like Barrett to be on that court, and so would Mitch McConnell.
Oh, 100%.
Right, and so we should all be very clear about, like, the motives are for the worst reasons, right? Like not, they're not, they're, the speed is not justified by proper motives. And so, look, I guess my point is this. I'm not sure exactly what tactics and what hands the Democrats should play, but my view is they need to fight and they need to play those hands. And look, if they still, at this point, I think we would all agree that if they don't do anything, she's going on anyway, and she's going on in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, look, I think they are fighting. I'm just, we tend not to disagree about stuff. But it is, you know, trust me, the Democrats, Senator Schumer, Feinstein, and others are rip-roaring mad and angry just like their constituents. And I don't want to be an apologist for the Senate Democrats in any way, shape, or form. But it is interesting. I see people hand-wringing and saying, do more, do more, do more. You and I both worked in the Senate, right? So we have some knowledge. And if you and I cannot be specific about the thing that you can do that can bring doom to this nomination or even extend the nomination for some period of time, it's just very facile and easy. And again, I'm not a defender and apologist for the Senate Democrats. It is a little facile for people to say, fight more, do more, do more, without saying specifically what those things are. I mean, there are very, very smart tacticians on the Democratic side, and it is unfortunate. This is a pure power play. I agree with all of that. But that doesn't mean that they can do something in response that's going to be, you know, deus ex machina, you know, or some solution from heaven.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. And look, I think this raises the bigger question. And I thought a lot about this of like, you know, we live in a country where we pride ourselves on checks and balances. And yet it feels like there really aren't any on this particular question, right? I mean, and so the Republicans right now are unchecked.
As we said last week, look, Donald Trump said it best. If you have the votes, you can do whatever you want. And you look, the way to get back at those folks for all of this is come January of 2021 to have the votes in the Senate, in the House, and to have the presidency, and we can fix a lot of this stuff. So, Anne, we'll obviously be talking about this in the days and weeks to come. Meanwhile, I don't want to make any predictions about the debate. Some people will be listening to this before the first presidential debate tonight. Some people will be listening to this perhaps Wednesday morning after the debate. You know, I'm a little nervous about it. It's the first time these two guys have been up against each other. Bizarrely, did you see this? Bizarrely, the president of the United States has asked that Biden take a drug test because he claims he has taken performance-enhancing. By the way, I want to know what those performance-enhancing drugs are. Maybe I could do a better podcast. I'd like to know, what is the drug that I can take to make us better at doing this performance? Did you see then?
Have you also ever noticed that the president always accuses other people of the things that he himself has been accused of? So people have raised questions about his performance in certain speeches. And, you know, he obviously has appeared to stumble when he was walking down the ramp to Air Force One recently. And so whatever he's sort of been attacked for or questioned for, he always seems to turn back against other folks.
Yeah. So essentially the challenge was from the president that both men, both septuagenarians, should pee into a cup. And maybe you want to read for folks, let's end on this note perhaps. The deputy campaign manager for Joe Biden, Kate Bedingfield, did you see this? Did you want to read the statement that she put out in response to the challenge?
Yes. So I think, you know, what's so interesting to me is we're now in a place where it's just like we're living in the world of crazy. And so, you know, I think there's a really interesting question, and we're going to see it tonight, of like, how do you meet President Trump's, like, his inaccuracies, his lies, the crazy things he says. And so here's what I think is a little foreshadowing of what's going to come. The Biden campaign released a statement ahead of tonight's debate saying, quote, Vice President Biden intends to deliver his debate answers in words. If the president thinks his best case is made in urine, he can have at it. We'd expect nothing less from Donald Trump, who pissed away the chance to protect the lives of 200,000 Americans when he didn't make a plan to stop COVID-19. I think it's fair to say the gloves are off, and that it's...
That's too much image. That's too much imagery.
It's a lot. I feel the same. But it's going to be a feisty debate, I expect.
So I'll be watching, Anne. You'll be watching. I bet it'll be one of the most watched, if not the most watched, debate in modern times, I would think. And we'll be back next week.
Yes, we'll talk to you soon. Please send us your letters and questions to letters@cafe.com.
And by the way, make sure you sign up for the happy hour this Thursday, 6:30 p.m. Eastern time. Go to cafe.com/pre to sign up. And once you sign up, the Zoom information will be sent a few hours before the actual event. That's it for this week's Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, Nat Wiener, Sam Ozer-Staten, David Kurlander, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.